Legend of Yue Fei, Chapter 75.
Starting with some popular justice that's, well, it's pretty brutal.
We have to start with Zhang Jun. He's the big villain,
yeah.
Embodies all that corruption.
Right.
And when the public is baying for his blood, Madame Yue, she's managing the household, demanding her husband's honor be restored.
Mm-hmm.
She does something pretty unexpected.
Wait, she hands him over to the public. Is that, what was the thinking there? That sounds incredibly risky.
It was politically quite savvy, actually, even if it looks like anarchy. She basically declared that one executioner, not enough.
Not enough knives for all the grievances.
Precisely. So handing him over to the crowd, it was like saying the state's justice system failed. She validated the people's own sense of right and wrong.
Wow.
It's justice transferred from the, you know, the failed government to the people.
Yeah, this is where it gets really wild. Because the crowd doesn't just, like, tear him apart instantly.
No, they drag him to the lakeside. And maybe they sensed this was a moment. Because I actually created a system, an organized system for, well, retribution.
A system? How?
They realized, you know, if everyone just rushes him, the people with real grievances might miss out. So they made rules.
Rules for a mob. Okay.
Yeah, you had to approach one by one, state your specific unique grievance right to Zhang Jun's face.
Yeah.
And then you got to bite off a piece.
Bite off. Wow. Okay, that detail, stating a unique grievance, that changes things, doesn't it?
It totally does. It makes it less like random mob violence and more like symbolic justice.
Mm-hmm.
Each person reclaiming what they lost.
Right.
These weren't just random people. They were merchants, peasants, soldiers, listing actual losses. You stole my wife. You plotted for my land. Your corruption killed my father.
Yeah. The source really shows how deep his treachery went then.
Absolutely. Into every part of society. It's this literal physical outpouring of collective rage.
And the ending of this scene, the text notes something bizarre.
Yeah, it's darkly funny in a grim way. After he's basically been taken apart piece by piece, this vagrant shows up. No stated grievance, no political axe to grind. He just bites off the guy's genitals. The Yang Wu shows that even in this righteous vengeance, there's still chaos. And it symbolizes just utter disgrace for the villain.
Okay, so after that, public spectacle, General Niu Gao, the loyalist, he steps in.
Right. He handles the, let's say, the official cleanup, orders the quick execution and beheading of the other three main conspirators, Jin Shi, Mo Kixi, and Luo Ruji.
Swift justice.
Very swift.
Yeah.
And the four heads, Zhang Jun's, plus the other three, were then ritually placed before Yufei's spirit tablet.
Ah, closing the circle. Vengeance delivered, honor restored, symbolically at least.
Exactly. And just as fast, the families of these corrupt officials, the Jin Chen Jiashu, they're packed off to exile in Lingnan.
The whole family. That seems extreme. Was that political or just pure anger?
It's both, but mostly political, I'd say. Exile to Lingnan back then was practically a death sentence. It was harsh, remote.
So the message was?
Unmistakable. We're not just punishing the main culprits. We're wiping out their entire line, any chance of them coming back. The court basically used the public fury to eliminate a whole rival faction.
Justice served and the political slate wiped clean. Brutally clean.
Brutally, yeah. But necessary, perhaps, in their view.
But they couldn't exactly relax after that, could they? The reason for all this corruption in the first place, the Jin threat, that hadn't gone away.
Not at all. The luxury of focusing on vengeance was, well, extremely short-lived. Just days after the executions, bam, urgent military report hits the court. A Gaoji Benzong.
Bad news, I take it.
Very bad. Wuzu's huge Jin army was pushing hard, dangerously close to Zuxian town. All the ground Yufei had gained, about to be lost.
A total crisis. So the state needs a new general, like yesterday.
Exactly. And Emperor Xiaozong, he acts fast. He summons Yulei, Yufei's son.
Wow. That's a huge political statement, isn't it? Turning to the son of the general, they just, well, allowed to be executed.
It was a gamble, but probably a necessary one. The emperor needed legitimacy. He needed loyalty fast, and the Yue name. It still commanded massive respect from the army, from the people.
Appointing anyone else might have caused uproar.
Totally. Or confusion, desertions. This way, the emperor signals, I'm honoring Yufei's legacy, not siding with those conspirators.
Okay, so what's the command structure look like? Yulei is young, right? Who's backing him up?
They were careful about that. Yulei gets the top job. Supreme Marshal for the Northern Campaign, Cao Bei Dai Yuan Shuai. Big title.
But he's not alone.
No way. He's got seasoned loyalty right beside him.
Yeah.
Niu Gao is appointed superintendent, Jian Jun Deduo.
Which means more than just watching.
Oh, yeah. It's a check, a political oversight role, making sure everything aligns with the emperor's orders. keeping things stable.
Got it. And the brains of the operation.
Zhu Yi is appointed strategist, Jun Shi. So you've got Yu Lei for the name, the authority, the loyalty factor.
Right.
Then Yuo Gao for military supervision and political control.
Yeah.
And Zhu Yijin for the tactical thinking. It's a solid setup, designed to work immediately.
And they get a big army.
200,000 troops. The core of the loyalist military machine. They head out from Lenin right away. This is the state's response, the establishment hitting back.
The institutional power structure mobilizing.
Exactly. But, and this is where it gets fascinating, our story splits. While the state's massive army is rolling out, a parallel movement is starting up. Kind of grassroots. Private.
Yeah.
Driven by the sons of other loyal generals who died.
Okay. So a different kind of vengeance campaign. Tell me about this group, the Sons of the Tiger.
Right. First one we meet is Dong Yaozong. He's the son of Iron Face Dong Xian. And this guy, I mean, you almost can't believe the description.
How so?
He's huge. Built like a, well, a barn door. Face like a pot bottom. Immense strength. And his weapon, a 9-pronged sky-propping fork. Yeah, but like a massive one, weighing over 100 jin. That's, what, 130, maybe 150 pounds of just steel.
Whoa.
He's pure, raw power, nicknamed the Rolling Earth Tiger, Huan Di Hu. His mission, just avenge the Yu family. Simple as that.
Okay, so this force of nature sets off alone. And then...
he runs into the second hero, Wang Biao, son of General Wang Hang.
Yeah.
And the way they meet, it's quite something.
How's that?
Wang Biao is basically acting as a highway robber, holding people up for toll money in middle of town.
And a general's son, robbing people. Why?
That's the point the source makes, I think. His father died serving the state, right? But Wang Biao ran out of money just trying to get to the capital to avenge him.
Wow. So the system failed him that badly?
Completely. The son of a hero, reduced to banditry just to fund his quest for justice. It's a pretty sharp critique of the corruption.
So we have Wang Biao, the Shaking Mountain Tiger, Yao Shanhu, using a heavy copper rod, trying to get funds, and Dong Yaozong, the Rolling Earth Tiger, finds him.
Yeah, and they fight, like over 50 rounds, a serious, brutal fight. Shows they're both top-tier warriors.
But neither wins.
Nope. It's a stalemate until they finally pause, catch their breath, exchange names, and realize
they're on the same side.
Exactly. Both fathers were generals under Yu Fei. Both sons are out for the same vengeance.
So they immediately swear brotherhood. Powerful moment.
Very. But just as they team up, bam, the third hero appears and attacks them both.
Attacks them. Who is this guy?
This is Yang Jizu, son of the really famous General Yang Zexing, the one killed at Shaoxing River.
Ah, Yang Zexing's son. Okay. Is he tough?
He's clearly the best fighter of the three. Comes flying down the mountain on a white dragon horse, twin iron halberds flashing like snowflakes.
Twin halberds, nice.
And he knows both Dong and Wang pretty easily. Forces them back in fewer than 20 rounds. He's the tactical genius, apparently.
Okay, so he beats them up, then what? They fight him.
No, he explains. His backstory is just pure tragedy. Father killed by Wu Zhu, mother died of grief. He wasn't robbing people.
He was doing what?
He'd set up a whole fortress on Jilong Mountain. Operating from there, waiting for his own chance to get Wuzu.
Okay, so he's been planning. This confrontation then becomes a strategy session.
Pretty much. Yang Jizu, seeing they have the same goal, brings the tactical brain. He tells them, look, attacking Linan now? That's suicide. The capital's still too strong.
He reins in their righteous fury.
Exactly. He provides the cool head the other two maybe lacked. So the three of them swear brotherhood. They pull back to Jilong Mountain.
And the plan is?
Recruit more heroes first. Gather intelligence, stockpile supplies, build a proper force. It's a calculated strategic insurgency they're planning.
They're up in the mountains, basically looking for an easy score. Standard bandit stuff. They see some officials escorting prisoners, Jiguan, it's called.
And they think easy money.
Pretty much. They figure there's some, you know, cash, valuables, something they can easily shake down from these officials. Wang Biao even grabs his mace and heads down, expecting a quick robbery.
But it doesn't go down like that, does it?
Not at all. The officials, they're from the Ministry of Justice, they basically hit the deck immediately, terrified. They plead, look, we're not carrying treasure. We're escorting criminals. Human cargo, they're being sent south to Lingnan for military service, which back then was a pretty harsh form of exile. Brutal, really.
Okay, so not the payday the bandits expected, but who are these prisoners?
And this is where it gets wild. The officials explain. There are over 40 people, men and women. And they're not just any criminals. They're the families. The wives, the daughters, the sons of Qin Hui.
The Qin Hui.
The very same. and also the families of Mokixi, Luoruji, and Zhongjun, the key conspirators who brought down Yufei, their families.
Wow, so the officials basically have to give these bandits a crash course in current events to, what, save their own skins?
Exactly. They have to explain everything that's just happened. Emperor Gaozong dead. New Emperor Xiaozong is in charge.
And Xiaozong had a totally different view of the whole Yufei situation.
Completely. He wastes no time, pardons the Yu family, executes the main plotters, Qinhui, Mokixi, the others, and then orders these families, the ones the bandits have just captured, into exile.
So that's the official line.
Yeah.
But the irony here, it's huge. These were the families of the most powerful men in the empire just a short while ago.
Absolutely. Controlling everything from the capital. And now, they're prisoners being marched off to the frontier like common criminals. The fall from grace is just staggering.
It really is. But the story pivots so quickly here, doesn't it? From that official justice ceremony, the executions, the exile, to something else. How do the bandits react when they find out who they've got?
Oh, it's instant. They don't just rob them or let them go. They actually burst out laughing. The text says they declare, "This lot of treacherous bandits who knew they would have this day. It's raw."
Like the voice of the people almost. Yeah. Unfiltered anger.
Precisely. And it raises a good point. Why the bandits? Why have them carry out the next stage of vengeance instead of, say, more official executions?
Yeah, what's the narrative doing there?
Well, it's a classic way to show just how deep the hatred ran. The official system dealt with the main culprits, right? But the popular feeling, the desire for retribution, often goes way beyond that. It's more visceral.
So having these outlaws, people outside the formal system, deliver this payback.
It's like the story saying, the injustice against Yufei was so profound, even the common folk, even the outlaws, demand satisfaction. It suggests kind of natural justice kicking in.
And the satisfaction they demand is pretty horrific. They don't just kill everyone. They single out specific people.
Yes. The sons. Specifically the sons of Mokixi, Luoruji, and Zhongjun. And the order is chillingly precise.
What was it?
They're taken to a place called the Stripping Clothes Pavilion, tied up, and the command is to have their heart and liver cut out. Guochuskin.
Oh, wow.
A ritualistic desecration. And then they're beheaded. Xiao Xiao. It's brutal, yes, but it's meant to be more than just killing. It's annihilation, spiritually speaking.
Good grief, cutting out the heart and liver.
It's deeply symbolic. Yeah. And then comes the final act, which really seals it as a ritual.
What do they do with the organs and heads?
They're immediately laid out on a table. Yeah. And uses a sacrifice. Giblidian.
A sacrifice? To whom?
Before the memorial tablets of General Yufei himself and his son, Zhongjin, who died with him.
Okay, that makes a kind of terrible sense. Closing the circle.
And there's one more detail. One of the bandit leaders, Wang Biao, adds the tablet of his own father, Wang Heng.
Why? What does that signify?
It connects the national tragedy, the loss of Yufei, directly to the personal losses of ordinary people, represented by Wang Biao's father. It's like they're saying, this isn't just about the state, this affected all of us. The blood debt, both personal and national, is being formally paid right there.
So it clears the slate, in a way. Allows them to move on.
That seems to be the idea. The personal score is settled in this incredibly violent, ritualistic way, which then kind of paves the way for the national mission to take center stage without that baggage.
Right. And speaking of the national mission, the terrified officials, the ones escorting the prisoners, they have more information, don't they? After witnessing that, they're probably willing to tell the bandits anything.
Absolutely. In exchange for their lives, they spill the beans on the current military situation. And this is the big shift in the narrative moving away from the capital in the south towards the north and the impending war.
What do they reveal?
The big news. Emperor Xiaozong has appointed Yufei's son, Yu Lei, as the Grand Marshal for sweeping the north, the Saobei Dayuan Shui.
Grand Marshal?
Yeah.
That's huge for someone presumably quite young. A massive vote of confidence.
Enormous. It signals a total commitment to reversing the losses against the Jin.
And who's backing him up? Who's the inspector general of the Jianjun?
And this is crucial for anyone who knows the story. It's Niu Gao.
Niu Gao, the old warhorse. Why is his appointment so significant?
Because New Gao represents the old guard. He's the fiercely loyal veteran, incredibly brave, maybe a bit reckless, but utterly devoted to the cause Yue-Fei represented.
So putting him alongside the young Yue.
It's smart. New Gao provides that field experience, that continuity. He lends legitimacy. It tells everyone the troops, the enemy that this campaign has, the backing of the past heroes, and the energy of the new generation. It's serious business.
And the scale of it.
Massive. 200,000 troops marching north.
200,000. And the goal.
Not just to push back the Jin leader, Wu Zu. The ultimate aim is to defeat him and rescue the two Song emperors who were captured decades ago by the Jin and are still being held. High stakes doesn't even begin to cover it.
So when the bandit leader, Yang Jizu, hears all this,
he has this realization. Their life, hiding in the mountains, robbing people, it's suddenly meaningless compared to this huge national effort. The moral center has shifted.
He wants in on the real fight.
Exactly. He basically says, let's ditch this bandit gig and go help him out. Join the army. Fight for the cause.
A total turnaround. From outlaw to patriot.
It's a classic narrative arc. So Yang Jizu stays behind to sort out their supplies, while the other two, Wang Biao and Dong Yaozong, they hurry off to find Yule's camp.
Which is where is?
Zuxian Town.
Ah, Zuxian Town. That name rings a bell. Huge symbolic importance, right?
Evidence.
Yeah.
It's where Yue-Fei himself won a major victory right before he was recalled and betrayed. So for his son, Yue, to set up his command post there, it's potent symbolism. Returning to the site of his father's triumph to avenge his father's fall.
So Yue arrives, sets up camp. Meanwhile, what's the enemy thinking? What's Wu Zu, the Jin leader, make of all this?
He gets the intel, naturally. Here's that Yue, or as he contemptuously calls him, Yunnan Man's son, son of the southern barbarian Yu, has arrived with an army.
And he's worried.
Not in the slightest. Total dismissal. He basically calls Yue a junior commander, Hubei Shao, or a kid. Wu Zu is arrogant. He thinks the Southern Song is finished, scraping the bottom of the barrel by sending inexperienced youngsters.
Famous last words, maybe. That kind of arrogance often precedes a fall in these stories.
Almost always. And Yue immediately challenges that arrogance. He gets to his command tent, takes charge, and asks for a general to lead the vanguard.
The two Zen, the first strike against the Jin camp.
Who steps up?
Young Kongshan volunteers immediately. His nickname is impressive. Five Directions, Grand Marshal Jupiter Wu Van Tai Sui. Sounds like a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, that's quite a title. So Yue trusts him.
Instantly. Gives him 3,000 men, tells him to go make the first move.
Why is that first move, that vanguard action, so critical here? It's more than just tactics, isn't it? Oh, absolutely. It's all about momentum and morale. Think about it. 200,000 troops have just marched north, full of hope and desire for revenge. The first engagement has to be a success.
A failure would be disastrous for morale right at the start.
Exactly. So Uyang Kongshan stepping up shows eagerness, shows fighting spirit, and Yue letting him go shows confident command. They need a win right out of the gate, a decisive one.
So Kongshan leads his men out. Who does he face from the Jin side?
The Jin forward commander, a guy named Tu Delong. And the source makes him sound visually intimidating. Blue face, bulging red eyes, gold armor, carrying a huge steel rod. Looks like a real monster.
The perfect first boss fight, basically.
Pretty much. Tu Delong comes out just as arrogant as Wu Zu, tells Kongshan to surrender or die.
But Kongshan isn't backing down. What's he armed with?
Double axes. And he goes right at Tu Delong. It's axes versus the heavy steel rod.
How does the fight go?
It's intense, but maybe not as long as you'd expect, given Tu Delong's appearance. The source says no more than 12 or 13 rounds initially. It even notes that Tu Delong looked impressive, but wasn't actually that skilled Zhang Kung Bu Zhang Qi. All show, no go.
All bark, no bite.
Right. Whereas Kongshan is fighting, like, his life depends on it, Ping Ming Day. He's desperate for this first victory. He manages to block the steel rod with one axe.
Creating an opening.
Just for a split second, but it's enough. He brings the other axe down hard, fatal blow. Splits Tu Delong's head, the source says, into two halves, just like that.
Clean kill. First fight, first victory.
Decisive. Uyang Kongshan takes the head, returns to camp a hero. Wu Zu's dismissal of Yue already looks foolish.
Yue rewards him.
Immediately. Awards him the first merit, the Di Gong. It's the perfect start. Couldn't have gone better for the Song Army. That brings out these three brothers.
They do brothers, yes. Tu Dehu, Tu Debiao, and Tu Debao. They basically demand Wu Zu let them go get revenge.
And he gives them troops. 5,000.
Yep, 5,000 troops. And what's really fascinating, like you said, is how the author gives these guys these incredibly theatrical descriptions, almost over the top.
They sound terrifying on paper.
Right. Only for them to be, well, dispatched almost instantly.
It really stands out. Tudahu, the oldest one, has a face like red sunset glow and monster eyes like lanterns. That's quite the image.
And he's got a wolf fang mace. Then there's Tudibio.
The one with the iron fan mouth and copper bell eyes, wielding a goose wing sword.
Uh-huh. But the real showstopper introduction is Tudibao, the youngest.
Oh, yeah. The text just goes all out for him. A head as big as a winnowing basket, a blue face, 12 feet tall.
12 feet tall and the strength of several thousand pounds. He's carrying a serpent spear. I mean, he sounds like a mythological giant.
Okay, so that's the question then. Why spend all this narrative energy making them sound like, I don't know, final bosses, only to have them killed off almost immediately? What's the point?
Well, I think it's about narrative efficiency, you know? The author needs to show us that the Song generals, Ji King, Zong Liang, Yu Lei, are incredibly competent.
Okay.
They can handle a conventional threat, even a really imposing one. It sets a baseline for victory.
So that when the real threat shows up later.
Exactly. The impact is that much greater. You need to clear the board of the tough but beatable guys first to make the next enemy feel genuinely unstoppable. Existential, even.
Makes sense. And General Ji King, the Song general, he seems to know they're not the main event. His taunt is brutal.
It really is. Telling them to line up their necks to save him the effort. Pure confidence.
And he backs it up fast.
He does. The first duel is Ji King against Tudahu. They go at it for, what, 20 or 30 exchanges? Pretty standard fight.
Until Duhu starts losing ground.
Right. And his brother, Tudibao, makes a mistake. He tries to jump in and help.
A two-on-one. Bad move in these stories, usually.
Very bad move. Before Debiao can even really engage, Zong Liang intercepts him. Bam! Hits him in the waist, knocks him right off his horse.
And Ji King doesn't miss a beat.
Not at all. Sees Dehu is distracted, turns, and just smashes his skull with his own mace.
Yeah.
It's quick, brutal, coordinated.
Wow. A clean double kill. It shows the Song forces are skilled, they work together.
Precisely. It confirms, okay, the Song can handle guys who look tough. But like you said, that victory is short-lived.
Because the news gets back to Wuzu.
And Wuzu is furious. This is a humiliation. He needs someone who can deliver real revenge.
Which brings us to the turning point of the chapter, doesn't it? The arrival of the real threat.
Yes. This is where the author completely flips the script. Wuzu calls for a champion, and forward steps the great marshal Nian Deli.
Nian Deli. Okay, the name even sounds formidable.
And the scale just leaps upwards instantly. Nian Deli volunteers, takes 3,000 troops. But it's his description. It signals a shift from, like, heroic fighters to something almost supernatural.
He's compared to a Vajra, like a Buddhist guardian deity, or a Persian hero.
Exactly, yeah. Not just a big strong guy anymore. This is something different.
And his appearance. Face like red copper, mouth full of yellow hair like wax glue. Okay.
But forget the descriptions for a second. The real tell is his weapon, a massive purple gold hammer. Weighing 120 jin.
120 jin. How much is that in, like, modern terms?
We're talking about 160 pounds, roughly.
160 pounds?
Yeah.
For a hammer that he swings in battle.
Yep. It's not just heavy, it's symbolic, right? It represents this brute, overwhelming force.
Yeah.
The kind of power that skill alone just can't counter.
A pure power mismatch.
Totally. And it's worth remembering, you know, the Jin army, sometimes called Tartars in older texts, they represent this immense nomadic military pressure on the Song dynasty.
Yeah.
Nian Deli is that pressure personified.
And you see that mismatch immediately when he goes up against the first Song general. Niu Tong, was it?
Yeah, Niu Tong, who boasts about being the golden-haired great star of calamity.
Famous last words, maybe?
Pretty much. That boasting gets shut down instantly.
Yeah.
Nian Deli's first hammer swing hits Niu Tong's saber, and it just stuns Niu Tong's arms. The text is explicit. Skill means nothing here. Power wins.
So the Star of Calamity is just...
neutralized.
Humiliated. The second swing comes, and Niu Tong has to basically fall off his horse to dodge it. Then Luo Hong tries stepping in.
How does he fare?
Last maybe four or five exchanges, then he's forced to retreat too. It's a disaster. It shows everyone, okay, our individual heroes can't handle this guy.
This is a real crisis for the Song Command.
It absolutely is. Yu Lei sees the danger immediately. He has to escalate. He sends in four veteran generals.
Zong Liang, Wuyang Kongshan, Yu Lei, Zheng Shibao, heavy hitters.
Right. To try and stabilize things, cover the retreat. They engage Nian Deli in that running lantern style fight the text describes.
Sounds chaotic, spinning around him.
Yeah, hitting him with everything. They've got iron rods, axes, hammers, pikes. Four on one.
And surely four veterans can take down one man, even with a giant hammer.
You'd think so. But no, Niandeli isn't just strong. He's relentless. The author stresses he's not afraid at all.
He just keeps going.
Fights over 40 exchanges and gets more spirited, apparently. It's that classic unstoppable juggernaut trope.
Wow.
The four veterans, they have to pull back as night falls. They failed completely.
So the next day, what's Yuli's move? He's running out of options.
He commits everything. A massive force, 10 young generals, including his own brother, Yu Ting. They try to just swarm Niandeli, overwhelm him with numbers.
10 generals plus their troops? That must be chaos.
Utter chaos. And the author uses this moment for some really vivid, brutal imagery. Flashing banners, thunderous drums, the sky darkens, sand flying.
Arrows like locusts. Halberds dense as hemp. It sounds terrifying.
The battlefield turned into a meat grinder. The description gets really visceral. Rolling heads, eyes flying randomly. It's not heroic duels anymore. It's just slaughter.
But even 10 generals are enough.
Not even close. Because just as the song is throwing everything in, Wuzu sends reinforcements for Niandeli. Four more elite Jin commanders.
Oh, come on. Reinforcements for the unstoppable guy?
Yep. Including names like Sali Han and Kong Yanzu. The song's young generals are completely overwhelmed. Their numbers, their youth, it's useless against Niandeli plus fresh elites.
So they break. They have to retreat again.
They're routed. They flee back to camp. And they need defensive weapons, bird guns, spray tubes, hard crossbows, just to keep the pursuers off them.
This is bad. It proves the entire song military structure, veterans and young heroes alike, can't beat this guy head on.
Exactly. Definitive, crushing proof. So Yule and his strategist, Zhu Zijin, they face this huge strategic problem. Fight and lose.
Or what? Surrender isn't really an option.
So they make a really interesting call. Yule decides to raise the no fighting banner. You Amazon pie.
The no fighting banner. What exactly does that signify? It's not surrender, is it?
No, not surrender. Think of it like calling a timeout in a game where you're getting absolutely destroyed. It's a strategic pause.
Buying time.
Exactly. It's crisis management. Zhu Jin, the strategist, supports it. He even predicts, you know, some future general will arrive to help them. But for now, they need to stop the bleeding. Pride would cost them the war right now.
But strategy and pride, they don't always mix, do they? Especially not in these epics.
They certainly don't. Cue General Niu Gao.
Ah, Niu Gao, the loud uncle figure, always ready with an opinion.
That's him. The classic archetype of, let's say, unchecked bravado. He is absolutely furious.
About the banner.
Yes. He thinks Yule is shaming his famous father, Yufei, by raising a no-fighting banner after just one big loss. He completely ignores all the evidence.
That Niandeli is basically invincible.
Right. And Niu Gao boasts he will go out and capture Niandeli himself with his twin maces.
Oh, Niu Gao. You just know this is going to end badly. It's such a classic setup for hubris leading to downfall.
Textbook disaster setup. He rushes out all bluster, swings his maces first.
Don't tell me Niandeli takes him out in one hit, too.
Faster than the two brothers' fight even lasted. Niandeli's counterstrike with that purple gold hammer, it's instant. Catastrophic.
He just blocks it.
Tries to block it. The force makes his hands go numb instantly. And the text gives this incredibly specific, painful detail. His tiger mouths.
The webbing between the thumb and forefinger.
Exactly. They're described as being cracked open, which in context is like saying both his wrists were instantly shattered. It's devastating. It shows the immediate, brutal consequence of his pride.
Wow. One blow. All that boasting and it's over in a second.
Just like that. And the final humiliation. After talking so big, he's too embarrassed to go back to the song camp and face everyone.
Yo, what does he do?
He just crees into the wilderness, turns tail, and runs away from the battlefield with Niandeli chasing him on his camel.
On his camel? That adds insult to injury.
It really does. And that's precisely where the author hits the pause button. Leaves us hanging.
With that classic line, whether Niu Gao survives, please listen to the next chapter. Perfect cliffhanger.
Couldn't write it better myself.